Los Angeles. Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the motives behind President Trump's bombing of the Syrian airbase and the mixed signals coming from his administration, with his UN representative Nikki Haley advocating regime change, saying that there can be no peace in Syria with Assad in power, while Secretary of State Tillerson says there is no change in U.S. policy, with destroying ISIS still the main objective. Thomas Wright, a fellow and director of the Project on International Order and Strategy at the Brookings Institution and author of the forthcoming book All Measures Short of War, The Contest for the 21st Century and the Future of American Power, joins us to discuss the EU conference on reconstructing post-war Syria that was meeting in Brussels when the chemical attack occurred, raising doubts about whether the billions pledged will be forthcoming. Then we'll examine how much the bombing of Syria distracted attention away from the inquiries into possible collusion between the Trump administration and the Russians. Mark Lowenthal, the president of the Intelligence and Security Academy, who was the Republican staff chairman or staff director of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, joins us to discuss the damage that Devin Nunes has done to the House Intelligence Committee and how much it will impact the Russian investigations going forward. Then finally, following the cruise missile attack on Syria, with CNN's Fareed Zakaria declaring, quote, that I think Donald Trump became president of the United States last night. We will look into the cheerleading in the press that has accompanied Donald Trump's use of military force against the Assad regime and speak with Eric Bollett, a senior fellow at Media Matters for America and author of Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush and Bloggers on the Bus, How the Internet Changed Politics and the Press. He joins us to discuss the unusual praise for Trump coming not just from the expected sycophants at Fox News, but for many of the anchors on MSNBC, such as Rachel Maddow and Brian Williams, who are normally critical of Trump. And joining us now is Thomas Wright, who's a fellow and director of the Project on International Order and Strategy, as well as a fellow in the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. His forthcoming book is All Measures Short of War, The Contest for the 21st Century and the Future of American Power. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Wright.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, thank you, Thomas. And there was an unexpected use of American hard power in Syria after years and years of wanting to stay out. And, of course, lots of Monday morning quarterbacking over the 2013 red line that was crossed, and Obama backed away from his threat, which led to a Russian brokered deal to get rid of Assad's chemical weapons, which clearly was not complete. So a little bit of history there, but what do you think was the motivation here? Was it because Trump watches a lot of television and was influenced by the pictures of these babies? He called them beautiful babies poisoned by this horrible gas. And it certainly has changed the conversation. So a lot of critics are saying, well, this is a kind of wag the dog situation where he's removing unpleasant coverage about possible involvement with the Russians from the headlines. So what do you think?
Yeah, I think what happened was a more sort of fundamental shift for President Trump. I think we have to start with the question, why did the attack take place? Like, why did Assad use chemical weapons in the first place? Obviously, he's used them on a small scale before, but this was a very provocative act. And I think the simplest explanation is probably true, which is that he thought Trump didn't care. He thought that he had a carte blanche to do what he wanted. Trump said repeatedly that he didn't mind what Assad did inside his own borders, that, you know, the U.S. didn't want to get rid of Assad, that he wanted to work with the regime against ISIS. So I think Assad thought, you know, the President of the United States and the Secretary of State are essentially saying, I have a green light to do anything I want. And then when he did launch the chemical weapons attack, I think Trump was confronted with what America First leads to when taken to its logical conclusion, and it leads to mass atrocities and the very moving images that we all saw on television, And I think he had a gut sort of reaction, which was he couldn't just continue to give a carte blanche. He had to say that it wasn't acceptable, and he did. And the strike that took place, I think, was really the minimum sort of strike that you could conceive of that would register disapproval, you know. And so what he was essentially saying was, you know, I don't want you to use chemical weapons. It wasn't totally unlike what President Obama did either in 2013, even though he didn't sort of follow through in the strike. So I think that's sort of what it was. I'm not sure. I think he's saying that there's no carte blanche there, but he's also not sort of yet saying that he's going to intervene or fundamentally change his strategy or that he wants to get rid of Assad.
Well, do you think though that either he or Tillerson or Nikki Haley are sort of have any kind of remorse or rethinking what they said? If it did unwittingly give Assad a green light, I mean, the extent to which also you have to add to that, I think the images of General Sisi there being feted at the White House and treated very warmly by President Trump, that he's not exactly anything but a despot. He's got, what, 40,000 or 50,000 Egyptians in jail. He's using torture, etc. So do you think anybody in the Trump administration recognizes that maybe they unwittingly gave Assad the green light?
Well, if they do, I sincerely doubt they would say it publicly. You know, I mean, it's not the president's style to do that, and it would be obviously politically dangerous for them if they were to do so. So I wouldn't expect them to sort of acknowledge mistakes on that, even though I think it was a huge mistake to have the language they had in the run-up to it. But I think what you know, people will be looking for is sort of a change in course. I will say that I think since the strike, I mean, there's been some mixed signals, including from Haley saying one thing, Tillerson saying another. But based on Tillerson's comments, it does seem we're going back to the status quo as it was before the chemical attack. You know, that they're saying so Tillerson said this morning that that the counter-ISIS efforts are being coordinated with the Assad regime. He's saying ISIS is the first priority. I think what they're all hoping for is that Assad will sort of get the message, don't use chemical weapons, and then we can get back to the way it was. I expect that Assad will do that. I don't think Assad will really escalate here. And so I think I don't see it as sort of a fundamental sort of change in the long run. It was really a marker that was laid down to say, you know, that the United States didn't want WMD being used on a regular basis in Syria.
And again, I'm speaking with Thomas Wright, who's a fellow and director of the Project on International Order and Strategy, as well as a fellow in the Center of the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. His forthcoming book is All Measures Short of War, The Contest for the 21st Century and the Future of American Power. So at this point, you just mentioned the contradictions between Nikki Haley on the Sunday program saying there's not any sort of option where a political solution is going to happen with Assad as a head of regime. Regime change is something that we think is going to happen because all of the parties are going to see that Assad is not the leader that needs to be taking place for Syria. And of course, Tillerson more or less said, no, our real priority is ISIS. And he's on his way to Russia, I imagine, to smooth the ruffled feathers there. But talk of greater cooperation with Russia, what's your opinion on that? Because I would have thought that this bombing would have driven Putin further into Assad's hands or Assad further into Putin's hands.
I think it will. I'm not sure exactly what impact it will have. I mean, you could see it either way. I mean, the Russians, there were some rumors that they may have been involved, but I think that it's also possible that they're upset with the regime for sort of jeopardizing the relationship with Trump. If you think about it from the Russian and the Assad sort of strategic point of view, I mean, their goal here has to be to prevent Trump from getting dragged into the war against them. You know, that's their major objective, because if they retaliate or if they're very sort of upset at the attack and they respond either by using chemical weapons again or in some other way, then that would be counterproductive for them, I think, because Trump could react badly to that and get more engaged. and that would tilt the balance of power. So I actually think that the Russians have an interest in trying to smooth this over. I wouldn't be completely surprised if they came up with a scapegoat for the attack in time and sort of disavowed it or said that it wasn't anything to do with them. And I think that the visit of Tillerson to Russia, the risk is not that it goes incredibly badly and they sort of fall out. I think the risk is still, too much cooperation with Russia, sort of unilateral concessions. I don't think that risk has gone away with the strike. I think the Russians have to, of course, condemn it, and they, you know, they said that they'll strengthen Syrian air defense and those capabilities. But I haven't seen anything yet that would really sort of register like a serious, you know, opposition to it and retaliation against the United States.
Well, the conference was taking place in Brussels, led by the European chief, Federica Mogherini, and they were pledging $8 billion to reconstruct Syria, the European countries. And it's pretty extraordinary that the Europeans would be stepping up to the plate because, frankly, Russia and Iran surely could be held responsible for propping up this Assad regime. And therefore, if you guys have kept him in power, you're responsible to foot the bill, the massive bill to reconstruct this country. And I would think that that would give America some leverage over Russia, because the Russians don't have that kind of money, neither do the Iranians. So what was going on there? What were the Europeans doing, even talking about pledging $8 billion, and then the chemical weapons attack, and of course that pretty much had Federica Mogherini, they're going to face, basically, then having to say that Bashar al-Assad is primarily responsible. Chemical weapons are the worst of war crimes, she said. So there's a couple of things, questions there. One is, what are Europeans up to? And two, why would Assad shoot himself in the foot like this? He wants all this money from the people who supported his enemies, frankly, and now it blew up in his face because he used chemical weapons.
Yeah, just on the second point first, I mean, I don't know why Assad used chemical weapons. I don't think anyone does. I haven't really seen a good explanation of it. I suspect the reason might be that if he thought he could get away with it, and he could use chemical weapons more broadly going forward, it would be, you know, a devastating sort of blow to opposition's morale to see him being able to use the full sort of scale of his arsenal completely unconstrained, and that it will be sort of a finishing move to try to win the war and show that there was, you know, no chance of defeating him or getting to a stalemate. So I suspect that was the reason. On your very interesting question on the aid and why not just leave the bill with Russia and Iran, I think the reason is that the Europeans, you know, are suffering the most of Western countries or countries outside the immediate vicinity of the civil war in terms of the repercussions of it. So the refugees crisis, you know, came very close to collapsing the European Union. It may have contributed to Brexit. It created an enormous backlash in Europe. And so they are experiencing the consequences of the war. And if Syria continues to fall apart and the region falls apart, then they will, you know, they will bear the brunt of that. In a way, Russia doesn't care as much, because to the extent that the refugees flows destabilize the EU, that's actually aligned with Putin's interests in undermining the EU. And of course, the Russians and the Iranians aren't going to pay, aren't going to foot the bill, even if they should. So I think it's probably a sense that they have a strategic interest in stabilizing Syria and the countries around it. I do think it's obviously fairly, it's probably not enough, and it's a little premature in the sense that the war is still raging on, and there's just no sort of sign of that coming to an end or what a real negotiation process would look like. But I think that's probably why they were inclined in that direction.
Well, but when you talk about leverage, in other words, I mentioned that the possibility that the U.S. has some leverage in these talks coming up with Tillerson and Putin in Moscow.
you know, the leverage being that, you know, you guys are going to be left to foot the bill because you supported and protected and preserved the Assad regime. But on the other hand, does Putin have counter leverage, as you just pointed out? I think what's missed often is that when the Russians moved into Syria in September of 2015, shortly thereafter, the massive exodus of refugees took place. And the former SACEUR, General Breedlove, said that Putin was weaponizing refugees. Assad and Putin, it looks like Assad and Putin worked together. Assad gave the people permission to get out. They, you know, basically starve, get killed, or get out. And thus, it does seem that Putin still has that leverage. There could be a whole extra, another flow of refugees into Europe, and he could pull the trigger on that. Is that a fact?
Yeah, I think he did weaponize the refugee flows. It may or may not have been his intention at the very beginning, but certainly when he saw it was possible, I think he welcomed it because he sees the EU as an existential threat to his regime, unfairly, I think, but that is the way he sees it. And I think he still has, you know, he's a major military player on the ground shaping sort of the day-to-day development. So I think he does have a lot of leverage over Europe and over the United States. He's made himself sort of an indispensable player there, and he can certainly ratchet up the refugee flows if he wants. So, you know, I think this is going to be a very interesting and important meeting with Tillerson, but I don't think that, you know, I don't think Putin's going to be in any mood to sort of make major concessions. I think if anything, he'll be frustrated at Tillerson for not being able to deliver, for the Trump administration not being able to deliver what it promised. I would worry a little bit that Tillerson will try to go a little too far in finding common ground, actually.
Mm-hmm. Well, why do you think, though, that the West and NATO don't see the obvious here? Or maybe they do, but it doesn't look like it. The reason that Putin invaded Crimea, I think, is largely because of the Black Sea Fleet and the warm water ports. And the reason that he's committed to Syria is because he has naval bases there. To my mind, that's what it's all about. It's all about Russia's military power and its access to bases. Is that too simplistic?
Well, I think it's a huge part of it. I think you're exactly right that that's a major concern. But I think it's also more than that, too, because my view is that in Crimea or in Syria, he could have, if he played a constructive role in the negotiations, he could have easily... ensured the continuation of those bases. You know, I mean, in Crimea, no one was really talking about getting rid of that base. I mean, it was just an association agreement with the EU. There was no prospect. That base wasn't going anywhere. And, you know, he would have had tremendous leverage if he wanted additional guarantees on maintaining the base. I'm sure he could have gotten them. And I think similarly in Syria, people know what he's sort of capable of, and in post war, you know, negotiations for the post-conflict situation, I think it would have been fairly straightforward for him to secure those bases going forward, unless, you know, Assad has completely collapsed. So I think it's you know, he obviously, I think, is very concerned about maintaining the bases, but I think he's also looking for ways to push back against the West to sort of undermine that post-Cold War order, to show that he is, you know, he's capable of unilateral bold moves that forces the West to react, you know, and that he's making Russia a significant military player in Eastern Europe and in the Middle East.
Well, Thomas Wright, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you so much.
And again, I've been speaking with Thomas Wright, who's a fellow and director of the Project on International Order and Strategy, as well as a fellow in the Center on the United States and Europe at the Brookings Institution. His forthcoming book is All Measures Short of War, The Contest for the 21st Century and the Future of American Power. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into the extent to which the bombing of Syria has removed the Trump-Russian story from the headlines.
Walk away now and
This is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Mark Lowenthal, who's the president of the Intelligence and Security Academy, a professor at the Johns Hopkins University. He served as assistant director of Central Intelligence for Analysis and Production, vice chairman for evaluation at the National Intelligence Council, deputy assistant secretary of state for intelligence, and staff director of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. Dr. Lowenthal is the author of the Standard College Graduate School textbook on intelligence, Intelligence from Secrets to Policy, now in its sixth edition. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Lowenthal.
Thank you, Ian.
And the fact that we plan to talk about the latest machinations over the House Intelligence Committee and Devin Nunes and where the inquiries both in the Senate and the House into alleged Russian interference in the American elections, how much are we overshadowed by what just happened? In other words, did the bombing of Syria take this story off the headlines?
A little bit, but it's going to come back because it's not clear that Mr. Trump has a follow-on. It's not clear that this is part of a policy. This was a reaction to a specific incident, the gassing and death of 84 people. And so the Russia thing will come back, if for no other reason than Congress is not going to give it up. So it will be back. And Congress is actually capable of handling more than one issue at a time, despite the way it appears.
Well, but the Congress is not a unified body, to say the least, right?
I mean, no, not at all.
So when you say the Congress wants to do this, is it the Democrats or the Republicans? Are they all on the same page? It doesn't seem that way with the behavior of Devin Nunes. He hasn't removed himself as chair of the House Select Intelligence, but he has stepped down from the Russia inquiry.
Right. Well, remember, there are two parts of the Congress. You know this, your viewers know this. On the Senate side, the chairman of the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, Senator Burr, and the vice chair, Mark Warner. On the Senate side, the ranking minority member is the vice chair, which is interesting. They're going ahead with their investigation, and they also understand, and it's partly with the structure of their committee, the importance of a bipartisan investigation. And I think, if anything, Devin Nunes's actions put even greater pressure on them to push ahead and to keep it bipartisan. Back over on the House side, the committee that I served on, Conaway is going to be under pressure. Conaway is a congressman from Texas who is going to chair the House committee for the Russian investigation. He's going to be under pressure to get the committee back involved for institutional reasons. Devin Nunes has done incredible damage to the House Intelligence Committee as an institution. He really has hurt it very, very badly. And this is sort of a long answer. One of the ironies is that if you watched the one open hearing that the House committee had on the Russia issue, there were three hearings going on simultaneously. Robert Comey and Admiral Rogers were trying to get facts. This is how we work in this area. The Democrats were constantly going on about Mike Flynn and Russia. And the Republicans were constantly harping on leaks. Aren't leaks terrible? So the irony here is that not only has Nunes had to recuse himself from the Russia investigation, he's now under investigation by the House Ethics Committee for leaking. So there's an institutional imperative on Conaway to get this back on track.
Well, clearly, though, Mark Lowenthal, the testimony by the director of the FBI, James Comey, and the head of the NSA, Admiral Rogers, was pretty devastating, was it not, to the White
very
House.
Much so. They stood by their guns. They said it happened. I mean, Mike Rogers, opened his testimony saying it happened. The Russians did this. And Comey was very, very good at explaining how they do investigations and also at refuting one more time Donald Trump's allegations that Barack Obama had been tapping Trump Tower. Congressman Schiff, the ranking Democrat, said, could President Obama order a wiretap? And Comey said very clearly, no, he could not. There was a time when presidents could do that. That time is long gone. So I think they actually did a remarkably good job at testifying and not losing their cool under very adverse conditions.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Lowenthal, who's the president of the Intelligence Security Academy. He's a professor at Johns Hopkins University and served as assistant director of Central Intelligence for Analysis and Production, vice chairman for evaluation on the National Intelligence Council, deputy assistant secretary of state for intelligence, and staff director of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. And Dr. Lowenthal is the author of the Standard College Graduate School textbook on intelligence, Intelligence from Secrets to Policy, now in its sixth edition. So how much is all of these machinations and the to and fro of Nunez in the Uber car and this young fellow on the National Security Council feeding him the documentation? It all looks as though what's really going on at the White House and at their National Security Council is an effort to get out from under the outrageous statements that the president made, tweeting out that Barack Obama was a bad, sick guy. Is that right? Is that at the heart of it all, that this is just...
Well, I don't think they were trying to get out from under it. I think they were trying to justify it. The name of, I don't remember, the Cohen Warnock, I think is the name of the...
Right, Cohen Warnock,
The staffer, the intelligence staffer, you know. He had some documents that he gave to... that he called Nunes up, and Nunes went to read. That was Nunes's first mistake. Then Nunes goes to see the president without the heck with informing the Democrats on his committee. He didn't inform his own members on the committee. And he goes to see the president about the documents that president's staff gave him, which he says the president needs to know. That's kind of strange. Why doesn't the president's staff tell him? Why doesn't Cohen Warnock go to McMaster's, or in those days you could still go to Bannon, and go tell the president? And then Nunes gives a press conference. The number of errors, of missteps that Nunes made is fairly incalculable. And he wasn't thinking about being a member of a separate branch, and he certainly wasn't thinking about being the chairman of an investigating committee. He was thinking about still being a member of the Trump campaign. And he did himself damage, and he did the congressional oversight process damage.
But didn't he?
And I say that as somebody who was a Republican. I was a Republican staff director of the committee.
Sure.
So, I mean, I had to choose sides. And,
right.
He just did incalculable damage. It was devastating.
But he did clear it before he went to the White House. He did clear it with the head of the House, Paul Ryan.
Yeah, but that wasn't the way to do it. And Ryan, it was wrong. Ryan, if Ryan gave him clearance, Ryan was wrong.
Mm-hmm.
It's just not how you conduct intelligence oversight. You're not there to represent the President of the United States. You're there to represent your institution, which is the House and the House Intelligence Committee. Now, sometimes in oversight, you're there to defend the agencies you oversee from unwanted criticism, and sometimes you're the critic. So, that defending intelligence agencies is not beyond the pale. But he was doing something else. He was trying to, sort of give some basis for Donald Trump's tweets. That had nothing to do with defending the intelligence community. If anything, he was attacking the intelligence community. He really lost the sense of who he is and what he should be doing, I'm afraid.
Right. But that's what I was suggesting, that it seems to be all about trying to give the president cover for his tweets. And I don't know whether this business about bringing the former National Security Director from the Obama administration, Susan Rice, into it, is that muddying the waters? Or is it, my understanding about incidental collection is that that just happens every day. And it's not a big deal.
Well, incidental collections happens every day. It does, because the nature of what we're collecting, you're going to sweep up a certain number of U.S. persons. And a U.S. person in law is not just a citizen, but anybody who's here legally with a visa and a green card. The issue they're raising with Susan Rice is that in certain instances, she asked to have the U.S. person, which is how it would be identified, unmasked. She asked to have the identity revealed to her. This is also within the terms of how this kind of material works. On occasion, there'll be a case with either a foreign policy nexus, a foreign intelligence nexus, or a criminal nexus, and a senior official will say, I think we need to know who this person is. And Mike Hayden, who is the director of both NSA and the CIA, makes an interesting point on this. He says, for this material to have even reached the assistant to the president for national security affairs means that the intelligence community had already decided this is highly significant. We collect reams and reams of data every day, and the things that get passed up the line to very senior officials is obviously very small and we consider very important. So the fact that this material with a U.S. person in it was even reaching her desk means that as far as the intelligence community was concerned, this was very important. So the fact that she then asked to have U.S. persons unmasked in certain cases, it happens very rarely, but it's not impossible. It's not illegal. There's no law about this. This is an administrative procedure. So I think it does muddy the water somewhat. I mean, apparently it could have happened, but it doesn't prove anything. It's not unusual.
It's not unusual, but my understanding of the difference here is, and you just said that the intelligence services may have alerted the National Security Advisor, as opposed to, it seems like, Cohen Watnick, the 30-year-old who McMaster wanted to fire because he was a leftover from Flynn, one of the so-called Flintstones. They wanted to get rid of him, and they couldn't because Jared Kushner and Bannon saved his job. It looks like he was actually tasking the intelligence community for, you know, just basically going, hoovering up all kinds of documentation, looking for something. That seems like a fundamental difference.
There's a huge difference. I think, now here I'm just supposing, so let's be very clear about this.
Right.
It would seem to me that what Cohen Warnick did was to go back to the intelligence community and say, were there instances in the past administration where an official asked to have U.S. persons unmasked? And, if I had received a request like that, I might try and not answer it and say there's no reason that you need to know this and things like that. But if the White House pushes hard enough, you would give up that information. And I think that was the information he then used to justify Trump's statements and the information that he passed to Nunes. So how Cohen Warnick got this information really becomes important. I would suggest to you that given the changes in the National Security Council staff over the last week, that Mr. Cohen Warnick's days may be numbered. As you said, McMaster's wanted him out. Bannon and Kushner saved him, but clearly Bannon and Kushner have had a falling out. Bannon has lost status. So I would think that McMaster's may still go after Cohen Warnick.
And just following up on that, Mark Lowenthal, of course, we learn now that the Deputy National Security Advisor, K.T. McFarland, is also being eased out and given the ambassadorship to Singapore.
Yes, but she's a very nice post, by the way. Mm-hmm. But yes, I mean, she was another person brought in by Flynn. She doesn't have a national security background, per se. She's a journalist, no offense, but she's not a national security official. And, McMaster's apparently, when he took the job, and after Flynn was fired, they apparently had a lot of trouble finding someone to take the job. McMaster's apparently said, I'd have to be able to name my own staff, and he was apparently told he could, and then it turned out that he couldn't. He apparently waited that out, and now he's making the changes that he wanted to make when he succeeded Flynn. So there are still some changes to come, I think, on the NSC staff. I mean, the changes that we saw this last week were obviously very important, very, very significant.
So turning back to the Russian inquiry, which definitely has been swept off the headlines by the bombing in Syria, and some speculate that that was on purpose, although I think the evidence would indicate, at least to me, that the president is very susceptible to television images. He watches a lot of television, doesn't he?
Yes.
So
he's also susceptible to his daughter, who apparently raised with him the horror of what the Syrians had done.
Right. This is at a time when her daughter is singing for the Chinese First Lady.
Yes. If you wrote this as a novel, nobody would buy it. I'm sorry. They just wouldn't.
Right. But, the Chinese love Trump and Ivanka. They think she's a goddess.
Although it's interesting, the Chinese didn't say anything. Trump told Xi Jinping at dinner, oh, by the way, we're bombing Syria. The Chinese, very tasteful people. They waited until Xi Jinping had left the United States, and now the Chinese press is going after Trump for what he did. Right. But I don't think Trump did this to sidetrack the Russia investigation. I think the Susan Rice business was meant to muddy the waters, as you said. But the Russia investigation is not going to go away.
Right.
It's going to come back. There's just too many odds and ends out there. I mean, they want to interview Jared Kushner and his relationship with the bank. They're going to interview Manafort. what's the name of the aide who said he went to, denied he went to Russia? Carter Page.
Carter Page, right.
Aide denied he went to Russia. Then it turned out he went to Russia. And now he's saying, I didn't give the Russian intelligence services anything significant.
Well,
what did you give them?
Right, but the Russian intelligence services, now we learn, tried to recruit him.
Yes, which is what they do.
Right, exactly.
But that's important. The fact that this man who is very senior in the Trump campaign, of course, you know, Spicer keeps denying that he's ever heard of Manafort and Page, which is also a separate sideshow. I mean, that's something that you want to know. You want to know how did they, what were they trying to get from you? What did they approach you with? I mean, these are important data points if you're in doing counterintelligence that you really want to know. They're significant. So this investigation, Syria notwithstanding, is not going away. It will be back. It may be taking a breather at this point. Clearly, the House Intelligence Committee has to regroup after Nunes was forced to recuse himself. The Senate committee is still there. Warner and Burr are trying very hard to keep this, as I said, on a bipartisan track. It's not going away. It isn't. It can't.
But already, though, Nunes did cancel what seemed to me an important public hearing where we would have heard from the former acting Attorney General Sally Yates, the former head of the CIA, John Brennan, and the former DNI, General Clapper. I think that would have been useful, wouldn't it? So,
So it would have been very useful, but I think it's going to come back. You know, when you're doing hearings like this, the way this works is that the two staffs, there's a Democratic and a Republican staff, on every committee. So in this case, the Republican staff, the majority staff, will talk to the Democratic staff and say, look, we're planning to have a hearing on such and such a date. These are the witnesses we want to have. Are you okay with that, or are there other witnesses? So that you have some semblance of agreement on a hearing. And I can assure you that Mr. Schiff and the Democrats are not going to let this go, and they're not going to agree to only have classified hearings. They want to have these hearings in public. And so Conway is going to be under a certain amount of pressure to stabilize the situation with his minority members, Democrats, and to make the committee look viable again. So I would not be surprised to see that hearing come back. And it's a good idea. I think I think you'll see that hearing again. And then they will also have to have closed hearings. They're going to have to talk to counterintelligence staffs and collection staffs about, you know, what did you know about the Russians were doing on a classified basis, contemporaneous with what the public story was. So it can't all be done in public, but I think that hearing will come back.
Well, just in closing, Mark Lowenthal, we're now learning that the former head of the CIA, John Brennan, knew about the Russian interference in the elections and briefed senior lawmakers back in July about the extent that the Russians were working to help elect Donald Trump president. Now, I find it absolutely mystifying that President Obama didn't make more of an issue of this, because this is like a Pearl Harbor on the very nature of American democracy, and it's a big deal, and he didn't make a big deal out of it. And then Hillary Clinton, now I learned from some people close to her, is that she's furious that her own people, Sullivan and Podesta, didn't brief her fully on the extent of Russian activity. And she would have made more of a deal out of it on the campaign trail. I'm not making excuses for her, because she ran an awful campaign, but I'm mystified by Obama. What do you make of the fact that he didn't make more of a big deal out of it? Because Trump himself has forward.
I would disagree somewhat with your character. It was not another Pearl Harbor, but I would disagree with that. But I think I understand why President Obama might not do anything about it, because that would then give the appearance that he was using the intelligence community to support Hillary Clinton. And I think even though he had knowledge of this, I think it puts him in a very awkward position in terms of what do you do about it. If you make this public, it then, like I said, it looks like you're using intelligence. You're declassifying intelligence. And the president has the right to declassify anything he wants. The president does not face any barriers to declassification, unlike every other official in the U.S. government. I always make this point to my classes. The president, by definition, cannot leak. But if the president had made that public, he would have been accused of using classified intelligence in an election campaign. And I think that was probably the restraint that he faced. I think that was why he ended up not doing it. Now, was that the right thing to do or not? Tough call. I'm not sure. But I think I understand the hesitancy about going public with it. And you can look back and say maybe that was a mistake in terms of U.S. interests. I think that's an arguable point. As you said, I don't think it would have changed the outcome of the election. Hillary Clinton did not lose this election because of the Russians. They certainly didn't help her at all, but they didn't cause the... In fact, Comey and Rogers were very firm on that.
Right.
They did not influence the outcome of the election. They tried to interfere in the election. And Putin had two goals. One was he preferred one candidate over another. That's not a big deal. The French are having an election. We have a preference. We don't want Marine Le Pen. I mean, Donald Trump might, but the rest of the government probably doesn't. We prefer that the British state inside the EU. So other countries have preferences and other countries vote. But the other thing that Putin was aiming for, and here, unfortunately, he's already succeeded, he wanted to cast doubt on the legitimacy of our electoral process. Because we raised issues about his election, and he wanted to say, I used to be in the arms control business, and we would negotiate with the Russians, and we would accuse them sometimes of violating a treaty. And the response was sort of along the following lines: no, we're not, so are you. Well, this is where Putin is with the election. My election may be corrupt, but so is yours. And he succeeded in that. That's already a win for him. But I think I can understand the counter-argument in the White House to not going public. And also, it's not clear how, when you have something like that, you want to be really, really sure that the intelligence is accurate. You want to make sure it's not a blip. You want to see a pattern over time. You want to have multiple sources. And so it's not like, you get this one piece of paper, you run to the White House, the president says something.
Sure.
It's a much more thoughtful, accumulative process most of the time. And so I can understand that restraint as well.
Well, just a quick last question and quick answer, if you don't mind. Why then does Donald Trump himself, of all the people who should clear the air, who's been accused of having Putin help elect him, you'd think that this guy would want to get out there in front of this and tell the world from day one that he had nothing to do with it, and instead he keeps obfuscating, which makes him look guilty.
Yes, it does, but you have to understand, Donald Trump was raised in the Roy Cohn School of Public Relations. When you're attacked, attack back. It doesn't have to be true, it doesn't have to be completely plausible, but get something else out there to divert the conversation. Roy Cohn was a master at this. He worked for Joe McCarthy, and he had a big hand in the schooling of Donald Trump. That's the answer.
Well, Mark Lowenthal, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Lowenthal, who's the president of the Intelligence Security Academy. He's a professor at Johns Hopkins University and served as assistant director for Center of Intelligence for Analysis and Production, vice chairman for evaluation on the National Intelligence Council, deputy assistant secretary of state for intelligence, and staff director of the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. Dr. Lowenthal is the author of the Standard College Graduate School Textbook on Intelligence, Intelligence from Secrets to Policy, now in its 6th edition. And we're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking to the cheerleading in the press for Donald Trump's bombing of Syria.
Well, ABC, NBC, CBS, bullshit, they give us fact or fiction. I guess an even split. And each new act of war is tonight's entertainment. We're still the pawns in their game. As they take eye for an eye until no one can see. Stumble blindly forward, repeating history. Television rules the nation. Television rules the nation. Television rules the nation. Television.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at ianmasters.com. And joining us now is Eric Bollett, who is a senior fellow at Media Matters for America and the author of Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush, and Bloggers on the Bus, How the Internet Changed Politics and the Press. He worked for 5 years as a senior writer for Salon.com, where he wrote extensively about media and politics, and prior to that, he worked as a contributing editor to Rolling Stone. Welcome to Background Briefing, Eric Bollett.
Thanks for having me.
And Eric, there's been a considerable amount of cheerleading going on in the press. Of course, you expect the sort of sycophantic coverage from Fox News, who was, for all intents and purposes, have become the Pravda of the Donald Trump administration. However, it's surprising to see, well, for example, on CNN, Fareed Zakaria declared that after firing these missiles, I think Donald Trump became president of the United States last night. Of course, that has echoes of what CNN's Van Jones said earlier after Trump's first address to Congress. And then, of course, you also have Brian Williams quoting the lyrics of a Leonard Cohen song, "I am guided by the beauty of our weapons," without any irony. So what did you make of it?
There was a few things. So those examples you point to were certainly troubling, right? Look, there's kind of an automatic in American politics and American media, particularly news television. You know, when the United States drops bombs on people, it's a big deal. It's going to get banner, nonstop coverage. And initially, all the coverage is going to be really good. All the coverage is going to be a certain amount of awe, a certain amount of deferential, you know, assuming, you know, the generals and the president know exactly what they're doing and things like that. So, I mean, if you go back to invasion of Grenada, if you go back to Panama, even these sort of small incursions, you know, not even, you know, Gulf War One or Gulf War Two, but even these small kind of 2 or 3 day events that we've seen over the last few decades, you know, it really fawning coverage. You know, when we invaded Panama, even though it turned out to be kind of a joke, the initial coverage was very rah-rah. So we did get, we got a lot of that. My main problem was the connection of the coverage to Trump, right? The connection to the coverage of this bombing, this one-time bombing of an airfield that we were told the next day was again operational. You know, there was reports that we blew up a mess hall, presumably empty. We blew up a radar. We didn't hit any planes. We didn't dismantle the airfield. What I thought was particularly odd was the jumping off point from that to Donald Trump is now presidential, right? To Donald Trump has now ascended to a certain level of leadership. He's a sober, serious person. None of this is kind of based in fact. And I think it's the press is from the day he was inaugurated, the press has just been really, really anxious to normalize, to mainstream his behavior, which is not normal or mainstream. And they keep looking for glimpses and glimmer of hope that something he does will be considered statesman or courageous. And I guess they decided this one-time bombing of an airfield would do for now.
But you mentioned the invasion of Grenada, and that was, in retrospect, a classic wag-the-dog situation. What had happened is the U.S. Marines had been blown up in the barracks in Beirut. The
day before.
The day before, and yeah. There was a flotilla of Marines heading for Beirut to reinforce. Oliver North had a plan ready for a wag-the-dog invasion of Grenada, and they jumped on it to take the Lebanon story off the headlines, and yeah. It was very successful. So is there a wag-the-dog component in this?
Well, I mean, you have to be, even if you're slightly suspicious or cynical, you would think yes. If you look at what Trump has done, your radar is really going to be ticking because, my goodness, a week before, the Secretary of State, Tillerson, made a public announcement where we don't you know, we don't really think Assad needs to be overthrown. We're fine where he is. Yes, there was this dramatic and horrific chemical attack, but reports I've seen, this is the third chemical attack since Trump was sworn into office. Probably the first with as many images and television pictures, but this is not anyone who's followed this horrific fiasco for many years in Syria. No one would be surprised, unfortunately, that this necessarily happened. So why was this 180 in a few days? And look, you know, and I think, of course, again, anytime we drop bombs, it's going to be a big deal. It was a very big deal because of how it happened, right? Everything that happens with Trump is so kind of bizarre and weird. We go from we're fine with Assad to 4 days later bombing his you know, one of his airfields. You know, there was no public discussion. He would barely even talk about what he wanted to do. So I think that added to the level of excitement or curiosity, however you want to describe it. Now, I will offer one caveat. You know, during the Iraq war, you know, the build-up to the war, the actual war, I would say there was an 18-month window where the U.S. press really, one of the biggest, most significant failures ever, right? They just got completely swept up in this war fever, and they backed this lie about WMDs, and for the first 6 or 8 months of the war, it was really not very good coverage. So with that in mind, I did see some real-time skepticism Thursday night into Friday, some, probably not enough. But I did, to me, it wasn't just a complete failure. It wasn't complete lapdog coverage. You know, I saw people on TV. I was reading things from serious people who were raising questions almost in real time, which, you know, if we want to look for a silver lining, I think that would probably be the silver lining to this.
Now, the Russians are reporting that only 23 cruise missiles impacted the Syrian airfield. The U.S. Military Pentagon said that they launched 59 missiles, one of which crashed shortly thereafter into the ocean. By the way, they're over 1.5 million apiece. So do you know anything? Has there been any reporting on the disparity between the Russian claim of only 23 impacting and the U.S. claim of 58 impacting?
Yeah, and you know, this is an important point that we haven't really seen that much about. We know almost nothing about what happened, because certainly there's been very little information from the White House or the Pentagon. And so, right, it's kind of weird. We're relying on Russian analysis or Russian evaluation. They put out some public statements. This is what they hit. This is what they missed. This is how many you know, the missiles arrived unscathed. It's kind of weird that why are we relying on the Russian government to kind of give us a very general idea of what happened with this U.S. attack? You know, even during, you know, W. Bush's Iraq war, you know, they embedded these troops, for better or for worse. You know, some of the coverage became kind of rah-rah. But at least we kind of had an idea of what was going on. From what I can tell, the Pentagon has released almost no information about this, which again just raises the point. You know, what was the goal? Was this part of an extended strategy? You know, I did see a headline, someone quoting defense officials saying, "Well, we never meant to, you know, take that airfield out. It was meant to send a message." Well, I you know, if you want to spend $100 million, I guess that's one way to spend a message. But for the press, I would be a little more concerned that we really haven't had any updates per se. We really don't know what happened. And again, it's kind of odd. We have to rely on not the Syrian government. We're relying on a proxy ally to tell us what happened. This is all very unusual.
Right, but maybe at the end of the day, we might learn that these multi-billion-dollar weapon systems that we pay a fortune for don't work. We know the F-35, the most expensive weapon system in the history of man, doesn't work. And they've had cruise missiles for a long time. By and large, they've worked certainly better than the Russian cruise missiles have, which, you know, some of them landed in Iran on their way to Syria. So That, I think, is an important question, isn't it?
Well, yeah, and what's the context? The context of this is Trump is asking for a Pentagon increase of $50
billion. $54 billion, yeah.
$54 billion. And this is at a time when the Pentagon budget, with Democrats and Republicans in agreement, has been on the decline for certainly as the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq wind down. There has been no Republican attempt, very little Republican attempt in the last 5 years to, you know, demand increase in the Pentagon budget. There's kind of a consensus that, A, our budget is already, everyone knows the statistics, you know, 10 times what most of the other industrial nations combined spend. But now Trump comes and he says, oh, you know, we're going to boost it by $54 billion. And people are looking at each other like, what are we going to do? We don't even know what to do with this money.
Right.
And so that's a kind of an important, that could be a helpful context for the press coverage. Like, you know, is Trump asking for a $54 billion increase because he plans on, you know, these $100 million kind of Tomahawk missile attacks on a regular basis around the world or things like that? So it's all very important in terms of the press and what they're covering and looking at the context. There was kind of some nonsensical narratives during the campaign that, you know, Trump was maybe going to be an isolationist or a non-interventionist. I think the press needs to kind of be a bit more clear-eyed. Isolationists don't ask for a $54 billion increase in military budgets.
Well, a lot of it, I think, is at the end, just in closing, is to do with what the president sees on television. He apparently stays up late at night watching cable news, which I think is brain damage enough for anybody. I don't know why he does that, but apparently these images did affect him. So we could well have a president who may be influenced by images on television more than anything else. So,
well, you know, just a quick point on that. I mean, that is his claim, right? I saw these images. I was so moved. I decided we need to bomb. Well, you know, we know that Trump is kind of an Olympic liar, right? He lies about things large and small. And so I'm kind of suspicious of why the press would assume on this issue, this is the one thing he's going to tell the truth about, right? Are we going to pretend that because it's an issue of life or death, suddenly Donald Trump can tell the truth about things? Or should the press look at it in the context of he physically has trouble telling the truth about anything? Therefore, why should we assume that the reason he told us we bombed Syria is the real reason, right? You know, the New York Times the day after had this front page piece about how Trump was following his heart, right? He suddenly was this wildly empathetic figure. Well, there's nothing to suggest that that happened. Anytime a president takes a country to war or even just a military event, you know, the press should probably be skeptical or in a healthy way. When the president cannot tell the truth about virtually any topic and he leads a nation to a war, a military event, that skepticism really should be off the charts at that point, I would think.
I thank you very much for joining us here today, Eric Bollett.
All right, I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Eric Bollett, who's a senior fellow at Media Matters for America and the author of Lapdogs, How the Press Rolled Over for Bush, and Bloggers on the Bus, How the Internet Changed Politics and the Press. He worked for 5 years as a senior writer for Salon.com, where he wrote extensively about media and politics. And prior to that, he worked as a contributing editor to Rolling Stone. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program's available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. You can also contact me, and I'll be back again with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.